Yes.
Oh, I like that. Hi. Oh, my God. It's absolutely wonderful to be back in paradise. Let me make sure we're on KVNF right here. This is a great podium. We'll have to use this for the next presidential debate. How many of you heard? Could you make the lights a little higher on the audience? I have this tremendous privilege when we go out throughout the country. You know, I don't get this in the studio at Democracy Now, where I actually get to see people. So when I do, when I have this opportunity, I'd like to actually see you as I talk to you. If there's any chance to bring up the lights a little bit. Oh, good. Okay. Okay. This trip has been truly amazing, and first and foremost, I want to thank Dennis, who not only is the coordinator of this 100-city tour, which I actually don't want to thank him for. I don't know, racing on hairpin turns, it's not my thing, but I'm a little weird that way. But, you know, the last two books have been our project together. Silence Majority in this book, I mean, Breaking the Sound Barrier in this book that came out this week, The Silenced Majority, Stories of Uprisings, Occupations, Resistance, and Hope. And I think the title very much applies to the debate that we just saw. It's what you didn't hear, what they weren't asked in the first presidential debate at the University of Denver, what the silenced majority cares about. Because I really do think that those who are deeply concerned about war, those who are concerned about the growing inequality in this country, those who are concerned about the raging wildfires here in Colorado, the drenching rains in Florida, the Dust Bowl conditions of the Midwest, are not a fringe minority, not even a silent majority, but the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media, which is why we have to take it back. And last Wednesday night, we had an unusual opportunity here in Colorado. So the first debate happened at the University of Denver. I mean, they shut down like half of Denver. People were told they couldn't go into buildings days before. So you had this gated debate. And the question was how you open those gates to hear other voices. And so just down the road in Littleton at a Comcast facility, we set up two similar podiums. I'd like to take this one and use it next time. I love this idea of the radio. Because I see the media as a huge kitchen table that stretches across the globe that we all sit around and debate and discuss the most important issues of the day. War and peace, life and death, and anything less than that is a disservice to a democratic society. War and peace. Now, I didn't hear war brought up in the first debate. You might say, well, that's not fair. We were talking about domestic policy. That was the topic of the first debate. Really, doesn't war affect domestic policy? The trillions that are spent on war, where does that come from? From closed schools, from people not having health care, people going hungry in this country. I'm describing our country, not a developing country or third world country. It has everything to do with every aspect of our society, including the soldiers who come home, leading to in Fort Carson, where we were yesterday, 114 times the death rate, the murder rate at Fort Carson than outside Colorado Springs, because these soldiers go to war, they come home, and they kill here. They can't seem to turn it off. You know, these soldiers, people on military bases, they can't have the debates there that lead, they can't have these debates about whether to go to war. Oh, there are some very brave souls who do. But they rely on us in civilian society that to have the discussions that lead to the decisions about whether they live or die, whether they are sent to kill or be killed. So to have an independent media that's not brought to you by weapons manufacturers who profit from war is a very good idea. You know, I come from Pacifica Radio, founded more than 60 years ago by a war resistor after World War II named Lou Hill, who came out of the detention camps and said, "We have to have a media outlet that's not run by corporations that profit from war, but run by journalists and artists." And that's how Pacifica was founded. That gated debate on Wednesday night, we set up two podiums just like the ones at the University of Denver. We invited third-party presidential candidates to be a part of the presidential debate. You know, we advertised, we put out to the radio and television stations we broadcast on. We broadcast on more than 1,100 stations right now, on community stations like KVNF, on NPR stations, on PBS stations increasingly, on low-power FM stations, of course, on the Pacifica radio stations. And we broadcast all over the world. We broadcast on television and radio in Sweden and South Africa and Japan, throughout Latin America. Our headlines are available in Spanish because in the Spanish media, it suffers from the same kind of concentration of media, where you have a lot of channels, but they're owned by a few media moguls that we do in the English language media. So to have independent headlines, for example, every day translated into Spanish on our website, if you're trying to learn Spanish, compare the headlines in English and in Spanish. If you're trying to speak it, compare the Spanish language headlines that we have translated into Spanish. Over 300 radio stations take those, and you can catch it all at democracynow.org. So there we were at the Comcast facility. Dr. Jill Stein joined us of the Green Party. She's the presidential candidate, doctor from Massachusetts. And Rocky Anderson, the former mayor of Salt Lake City, the Justice Party candidate, joined us. They stood at the podiums just like Mitt Romney and President Obama. Jim Lehrer began the debate. He asked the two major party candidates about the economy. He gave them each 2 minutes to answer. We paused the tape after Mitt Romney gave his two-minute response, and we said, "Dr. Jill Stein, your response." And then Rocky Anderson, "What do you say about the economy?" And then after his 2 minutes, now back to my colleague Jim Lehrer at the University of Denver. And we ran that debate from beginning to end just like that, breaking the sound barrier. This is what democracy sounds like. And there are so many issues that need to be discussed, and we need a media that discusses these. Yesterday, after being in Colorado Springs on this eve of the 11th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan, right? Tomorrow marks the 11th anniversary. October 7th, the U.S. invaded. The U.S. started bombing Afghanistan, now the longest war in U.S. history. We've got to talk about this. Yes, it was George Bush's war, but then President Obama inherited it and escalated it. Let's go back to November 2008, to the day that Barack Obama was elected president. I mean, it was a massive achievement for many movements in this country. The anti-war movement, right? The reason I think President Barack Obama was even the Democratic candidate is Iraq. He was running against Hillary Clinton for the Democratic nomination. She voted for the war in Iraq. He was opposed to it. She hung on to that to the bitter end. And then when she saw she was going down, she said, "Okay, maybe I made a mistake." But it was too late. The peace movement elected Barack Obama. Young people came out in incredible, unprecedented numbers. African Americans, people of color elected President Obama. The environmental movement, the gay and lesbian movement, movements across this country were galvanized. They didn't just vote. They got out there. They organized. I think the world heaved a sigh of relief on that night. And then what happened? Well, the community organizer-in-chief became the commander-in-chief. And so who community organizes then? The good thing is parents all over this country can say to their kids, maybe you can be a community organizer too. I think what happened on that night, for so long, people had felt they had hit their heads against a brick wall. The wall became a door. The door opened a crack. And the question was, would it be kicked open or slammed shut? And that's not up to that one person in the White House sitting in the Oval Office. Yes, he's powerful. But there is a force more powerful, and it is all of you at the Paradise Theater and people like you all over and not like you, this country. It is a story of movements and how powerful they are. When those who are used to having the ear of the most powerful person on earth in the Oval Office whisper their demands, if he can't point out the window and say, if I do that, they will storm the Bastille. If you're not out there, he's in big trouble. That's when he agrees with you. But what about when you don't agree with him? What do you do? Why didn't people who organized to elect President Obama keep pushing forward on all the reasons why you elected President Obama? I mean, I think there are a number of reasons. One is people are exhausted. I mean, the shock of this momentous event. I mean, if nothing else, electing the first African-American president in a land with a legacy of slavery is remarkable. But there were such high hopes. Then what happens? So the anti-war movement elects him. He escalates the war in Afghanistan. The environmental movement elects him, really hoping that the oil and gas presidents, you know, the Bush dynasty and others, that the direction would change. And then President Obama flies to Copenhagen at the UN climate summit, and he scuttles any kind of mandatory agreements, limits on greenhouse gas emissions that the majority of the world was pushing for. The drone attacks, President Obama saying boldly he has the kill list and he approves each and every person killed. There is a group from Code Pink who's now in Pakistan. You don't get this very much in the corporate media, who wants to present a different face of America to the people of Pakistan. Overwhelmingly, polls show there they view us as the enemy. America's supposed to be their ally. But because they have been so targeted in these drone attacks, I encourage everyone to read a report that's come out of Stanford Law School and NYU Law School called Living Under Drones. These law professors went to Pakistan and started interviewing people. You know, thousands of people have died in drone attacks, and especially in places like North Waziristan. And it not only talks about the casualties, but the breakdown of civilian society, because people are afraid to even gather, you know, like this, terrified that they could be struck in a drone strike. They're afraid to hold their jirgas, their meetings, because that's where they're afraid the strike will happen. Now, why are jirgas important? It's where conflict resolution happens. It's where the community works out its differences. It's where they govern. They're afraid. They're afraid to send their kids to school. This is what's happening. People in this country have no idea, and yet we must, because the drone strikes originate with us. Now, there are people who are doing something about this. There are the peace activists who have put their bodies out at the Hanford Air Base upstate New York and Syracuse. They get arrested. There are those at Creech and Nevada. They get arrested. You know, these places where they run the drone strikes. You don't have to agree with it. You could say the drone strikes are the right way to go. But we should hear these voices. That is the role of the media. Not to simply act as a stenographer to those in power, but to give voice to those who dissent, because dissent is what will save us. I see the media as a sanctuary of dissent. So, what do people do when they see the direction and the reasons they elected a president? And maybe you don't feel this way, but for those who do, what do you do? How do you make your voices heard? Where is the forum for people to have debate and discussion about these issues to make up your minds? Well, that's where independent media comes in. I remember a few weeks after Barack Obama was elected. The Obamas went to the White House. They were going to be toured around by the Bushes, you know, introduced to their new house. And I was invited on CNN to comment. It was like a big moment. And other pundits were on around the country. I don't consider myself, by the way, a pundit. And they were jabbering about something. And I'm seeing the Obamas walk into the White House. And I said, wait, we have to take pause. This is an historic moment. You have Barack Hussein Obama, Michelle LaVon Robinson Obama. She's the descendant of slaves from the Carolinas, which means their daughters, Malia and Sasha, are the descendants of slaves, and they're about to walk into the White House, the most famous house on earth, which was built by slaves. Let's just take pause. And I thought of a house not so far from the White House. on the eastern shore of Maryland. You know, that's where Frederick Douglass was born, the great abolitionist. That's where he was enslaved as a youth and a teenager. And it might not surprise you to know he was a troublesome slave. So he was handed over to a man called a slave breaker. His name was Ed Covey, his property, Mount Misery. And Frederick Douglass was tortured and beaten there, but Frederick Douglass fought back, escaped, headed north, and changed the world with his North Star newspaper. That property today, Mount Misery in St. Michael's on the eastern shore of Maryland, is owned by Donald Rumsfeld. He bought it in 2003 when he was Secretary of Defense. He lives near his close friend, Vice President Dick Cheney. When I learned that Mount Misery was Donald Rumsfeld's vacation home, I was very surprised. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm a journalist and I can't just absolutely be sure that this is true unless I go there and see this with my own eyes. And for all of you who rely on the internet, we must keep it open and free, and we must fight for it to be that way and not to let the cable companies and telecoms write the legislation that would privatize it, this incredible, invaluable resource. For sure. But it can also be an amazing global rumor mill, and you got to check out what you read there. So Dennis and I went to check it out. Now, I really love coffee, and especially organic coffee from independent coffee houses. And I love this place in Lower Manhattan. It's a red brick building. It's got this plaque outside, and it says, Frederick Douglass took refuge here when he first came north in this printing press building of David Ruggles, a freed black man born in Connecticut. David Ruggles had a printing press, and Frederick Douglass, you know, started the North Star newspaper. These men saw media as their form of emancipation, of liberation, because information is power. So we headed down to St. Michael's, and as we're driving in, I just have, like, it's the story of my life, unfortunately, like just an hour. You know, I am really concerned, and thank you so much for waiting, that we are late. You know, we started in Sarasota right after the Republican convention. We were 20 minutes late, and by my calculation, if we had 100 cities, by the last city, we'd be like months late. So thank you so much for waiting. Thank goodness you only had to wait half an hour, though I don't take that lightly. So once again, so we race into St. Michael's, but this is about the time I was supposed to be speaking in Washington, D.C., so we really had very little time. And we drive in, and I realize I have no idea where Donald Rumsfeld lives. How am I going to figure this out? But then I see an organic coffee shop ahead of us, and I say, oh, they'll tell the truth. So we went inside. They said, what would you like? And I said, I'd like to know where Secretary Rumsfeld lives. They said, oh, just go down the road. You'll hit Mount Pleasant Road. Don't go down that road. Make a right, another right, and you'll hit Mount Misery Road. Go to the end, and that's where he lives. So, okay, we're on to something. So we go down the road, and let's see. We don't go down Mount Pleasant Road, and we make a right and another right. It seemed we couldn't go right enough. And we head to the end of that road, and we see the black-tinted windows of the Secret Service SUV, and we know we have arrived. So I get out quickly with my video camera, and I'm zooming in as they're zooming out, and I'm thinking, does Secretary Rumsfeld know the significance of this property, Mount Misery? But sure enough, as I am zooming in, I see a stake in the ground next to the driveway that says Mount Misery. We head over to an ancient black church down the road. After all, it's Sunday morning. Folks are gathered in the sanctuary. And I go up to this woman who is a descendant of slaves. I said, I was just wondering, you know, if you could just say something about this historic place. Frederick Douglass was born here, tortured here at Mount Misery. It's now owned by Secretary Rumsfeld, who is known for torture. And what do you say about this? And she said, I can't comment now. We're in church. From Mount Misery to Mount Hope. I was speaking up in Rochester, New York, and after the talk, it was at a university, a young woman came up to me, and she said, could I take you to Mount Hope Cemetery tomorrow morning? I said, oh my God, I am flying. It was the middle of a snowstorm. I was flying to Denver at 6 in the morning. And I said, I am so sorry. She said, I'll meet you at 4. Oh, my gosh. Okay. So I went to the cemetery at 4. She was waiting, and we went to the tombstone of Frederick Douglass, brushing off the snowflakes. And she said, could I just show you one more tombstone? I said, oh, my God, I'm really going to be late. And she said, please. Okay. So we went across the cemetery, and there was the tombstone of Susan B. Anthony, who's buried next to her sister. Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass were not only allies, they were friends. There's a statue near Susan B. Anthony's house that is a statue not of a general, but of Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass having tea together. See, yes, they were also friends, not only allies. Frederick Douglass was not just an abolitionist, but a great feminist. He seconded the resolution presented at the 1848 Women's Rights Seneca Falls Convention for women to have the right to vote. And Susan B. Anthony supported the abolition movement in addition to being the great suffragist and women's rights advocate. These are the movements that have made this country great. And I headed off to Rochester Airport and missed my plane. So I call up Dennis. Now, I have to say, these books would not have been possible without Dennis. Dennis is an incredibly good writer. His intelligence and compassion, his organizing ability, his research skills, as demonstrated that day when I desperately called him. I said, oh my God, I have to get on the next flight to Denver. They are going to kill me. And he brings up the blueprints of the Rochester Airport. And he says to me, I said, Dennis, I don't need the blueprints. I need a ticket. And he says, I just need to know, are you in the Susan B. Anthony wing or the Frederick Douglass wing? I said, what are you talking about? Is this some kind of joke? And he says, no, it's right there in the blueprints. And sure enough, I look over and it says Susan B. Anthony. And in this wing, it says Frederick Douglass. Every once in a while, you have to stop and smell the coffee. So he got me a ticket and I headed to Denver and actually made the talk. But these movements, and how are they expressed today? Oh, look at the Arab Spring. Look at these momentous changes that have taken place in the last year. If ever you get dispirited, you know, how did you experience the Egyptian Revolution? Sharif Abdulqaddous, did any of you hear his remarkable reporting? My colleague at Democracy Now. You know, last year, he is getting texts from his cousins and his friends, I'm going to die for my country. And he's saying, for Egypt, he's an Egyptian-American. He said, this isn't the response of my family and friends. They aren't political. I mean, that isn't the country. Oh, my gosh, something is changing. And he flew right to Cairo and landed in Tahrir and didn't leave for 18 days. You know, Mubarak plunged the country into digital darkness. He shut down the internet. Actually, he used Naris, which is a California company, to shut it down. And when there was global outcry, Naris had to issue a press release saying something like, we were only following orders, but we've heard that one before. Even when the internet was down, Sharif became one of the top tweeters in the world because he worked a way around this. That is the industry and the passion and the determination of an independent journalist. And then they brought the internet back up and the thugs brought the satellites down. And the networks rely on satellites to convey their story. So you had Anderson Cooper in his hotel room with a lower third that said reporting from an undisclosed location. And he's on Skype like the old Democracy Now, sort of very fuzzy. And what was Democracy Now! Doing at that time? Well, you know, we started 16 years ago as the only daily election show in public broadcasting on a few dozen community radio stations. After the election, there was more demand for the show than before because we were bringing out the voices of people at the grassroots, asking in different communities in different states as the primaries were going on, how is it that in Haiti and East Timor and places like this, people are gunned down when they go to the polls, but they still go, the vast majority of people. But in this country, most people don't vote. But I didn't think it's because of apathy. I think maybe a couple things. People are engaged, and I wanted to know what they were engaged in their communities. These are the authentic voices of our country. And also, maybe they felt there wasn't a real big choice. I don't know. And I went, you know, we went around the country to find out. And so when we started Democracy Now! On radio, then television, September 1st, and then increasingly on PBS stations and NPR stations and all over the world. we could not afford the satellites. You know, these networks, they don't talk about this kind of thing, but they paid Saddam Hussein millions of dollars to use the satellites. And when Jeremy Scahill went to Iraq for Democracy Now!, he went into an internet cafe and using a special computer program that even the company didn't realize could be used for this, sent like 150 emails of the video pieces to us, and we pieced them back together in New York through the internet. Even when Saddam had created this firewall, Jeremy was able, with Jackie Suwin of Big Noise Films, to penetrate that. And here was Sharif, and here was... Oh, Sharif was an Egyptian-American, the son of an illustrious family, his grandfather, the most famous writer of Egypt, Hassan Abdel Kaddous. And then Hani Massoud also went, our video producer and cameraman, also Egyptian-American, leaps tall buildings in a single bound, played on the equivalent of the Egyptian national basketball team. You want him at your side in times of trouble. So he's videoing Sharif. The satellites are brought down, and Sharif is interviewing the people of Tahrir. He's interviewing Ahadef Suef, the great Egyptian writer who wrote Map of Love, Nawal Saadawi, the psychiatrist, the presidential candidate. She's written so many books. She was imprisoned under Sadat. She was exiled under Mubarak. She was holding salons before Tahrir when the young people were getting dispirited. What can we do? Saying, we will win, we will win. And the young high school kid who is putting out a tabloid, Voices of Tahrir, every week, bringing out the voices of Tahrir in the shadow of the state media building that has spewed lies for so many decades. And you're meeting this community. Because after Sharif interviews them, he stays in Tahrir, and Hani leaps over the burning barricades and makes his way around the camels that have been brought in to crush the protesters, heads home to Sharif's house, and he puts together these 20, 25-minute reports, and then he sends them through the internet, the way we have always done it from the beginning. Let's keep the internet open and free, and you would get these 25, 20-minute reports when the networks were showing you the bird's eye view, which was pretty impressive, but not hearing these voices of the people. Sharif, then, in the square, is being interviewed by MSNBC and CNN and all the networks, hour after hour, day and night, as he remains there. Of course, on Democracy Now!, we call that trickle-up journalism. And so we move from the Egyptian Revolution to what happened in Wisconsin. I mean, this was historic. This uprising, inspired by Egypt partly and inspired by Governor Walker as well, right? He becomes the governor, and though he doesn't run on this platform, he then goes after the public unions and tries to destroy their collective bargaining rights. That uprising, unprecedented in Wisconsin history. 150,000 people marched, and unlikely allies. We went, of course, we cover movements. We flew in a number of times to Wisconsin, to the state capitol, where people were occupying the building day and night, and I saw some of the biggest guys I'd ever seen, Oshkosh prison guards. And I went after them, and I said, who'd you vote for? And they said, Governor Walker, of course. So I said, so what are you doing here? And they said, protesting Governor Walker, of course. He didn't tell us he was going to go after the teachers and the nurses, our neighbors, our wives, our own teachers. And then there were the police and the firefighters. Walker assured them he wouldn't go after them, but they said, but you're going after our family. And they also knew they'd be next. And so you'd see these scenes outside Governor Walker's office of kids with dreads drumming and the police rocking out next to them. Unusual scene. It's interesting because later at Occupy Wall Street, I was talking to a police officer. He was sort of off to the side. And I went over to ask him how many people he thought were there on that particular day. And he said, could you tell me something? I said, what? He said, what are they saying over there? You know, he was hired, obviously. I mean, he was police. He was there. A very serious issue of crackdown on dissent. And I'll talk about that in a minute. And I said, well, you often hear them say things like, join us, and you are the 99%. I said, let me tell you about Wisconsin, where we just recently came from. There, the police officers joined with the protesters. He said, really? I said, where are you from? He said, New Jersey. And I said, I'm Native American. And he said, I know that I'm supposed to be apart from this. And he said, but I have been hearing some of the things that they have to say. So, Wisconsin. People sit in. It was historic. You had the older gentleman with glasses walking in the freezing cold weather with 150,000 other people with a sign that said, IRS auditors against Walker. There were very many surprising moments. And I look across from the state capitol building to the history museum and think about the University of Wisconsin Labor Archive. It's an amazing one. Just to put this struggle in context, especially for young people here, when you think, well, it's so black and white then with Dr. Martin Luther King, these were very straightforward, you know, issues. Today it's much more diffuse and it's not so clear-cut. I think you should think again. AFSCME, American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, born in Wisconsin, 1932. Dr. Martin Luther King died in Memphis, April 4th, 1968. He was assassinated. Why did he go to Memphis? He was simply marching with janitors who were trying to organize Local 1707 of AFSCME. Yes, there is a continuum here. People fighting together, joining together for decent lives. Oh, John Birch Society was also founded in Wisconsin, in Appleton. The co-founder of the John Birch Society was David and Charles Koch's father, and Bill Koch's father, Fred Koch. Now, here's an interesting side story. Right before the Republican convention, I went to a talk by Michael Cranish, and we ran it on Democracy Now!, and I check out democracynow.org just to see we played this part of the talk. Michael Cranish is a Boston Globe reporter who co-authored a book on Mitt Romney. You know, after all, Mitt Romney was the Massachusetts governor. We have to remind you of this because he doesn't like to talk about this. Right, he is the businessman from Bain, though he doesn't quite even want to say Bain right now, but that really is what he's been touting. And just a side issue, and Dennis's brilliance on this tour, leaving time for us to make these stops to do broadcasts from him. For example, well, we landed in Chicago with a teacher strike. Karen Lewis was on the next morning, one of the first national outlets she was on, the head of the Chicago Teachers Union. And then we drove out that night to an area of Illinois called Freeport. It's where the second Lincoln-Douglas debate was, 1858, Stephen Douglas versus Abraham Lincoln. Frederick Douglass, by the way, was there. He was a friend of Abe Lincoln's. But workers in Freeport set up this encampment across the street from their company. It's used to be Honeywell, now it's Sensata, and they make sensors for automobiles. Now, the reason they set up an encampment is when Honeywell was bought by Sensata, this company, they started to research because they were now training the Chinese workers who were going to take their jobs. They were told the company would close and it was being sent to China. 170 jobs lost. This is right now. And they brought in the workers for these workers to train, to add insult to injury. Some workers, by the way, went to China to train the workers. That's where they learned their company was being sold. They were upset, and they set up an encampment across the street. Why? Well, they actually had some hope because they did research into this company they'd never heard of, Sensata Technologies, and found out it was owned by Bain Capital. Bain Capital was outsourcing their jobs, is outsourcing right now in real time their jobs to China. So they thought, wait a second, Mitt Romney, he'll be in the two swing states that are right next to us, Wisconsin and Iowa, a lot. And he is a public face of Bain. He doesn't, not the head of it now, but he certainly profits from it now, and he certainly knows the people there. Maybe he could save our jobs. So they went to Bettendorf, Iowa, where he was having a rally, and they were very close to the front. It was Tom Gallrap and Mark Schreck. Mark has three little kids. We were there the day he called his little girl Kennedy, who was turning 5 years old that day, and he started to cry. Because he said he's afraid he won't be able to support his three daughters as a single dad if he loses these jobs. These guys and women have worked in this plant. I talked to Dot Turner. She's worked there for 43 years. I talked to a woman named Cheryl. She worked there for 33 years, as has Tom. So Tom and Mark head to Bettendorf. They're in the rally for Mitt Romney. And Tom gets up and he says, "Mr. Romney, what about our jobs, which are being outsourced by Bain?" And everyone around him starts chanting, "USA, USA." You know, this is a little frightening right now. I am seeing it not only at a Republican rally or at the Republican convention, at the Democratic convention as well. Every time there is any kind of dissent, there is this chant that goes out to drown it out, "USA, USA." It's frightening when the chant "USA" becomes synonymous with crackdown on dissent. By the way, at the Democratic convention, it was chanted when Code Pink activists held up signs that said "End the war." So here is Mark Gallrap, Tom Gallrap, and he says to Romney, "You know, what about our jobs?" And they start chanting "USA." He's taken out by Secret Service, and he says, "I don't get it. These guys at the rally were calling us communists." He said, "When we're American workers who are simply concerned that our jobs are being outsourced to communist China." You know, the grassroots struggles that are taking place right now, they break down conservative and liberal lines. Who knows who these workers last voted for? But the reality on the ground unites so many people. And that was just one stop. The next morning we broadcast from the Bainport encampment. They have renamed Freeport Bainport, and they're calling on Mitt Romney and President Obama to come. The mayor of the town, who said, "Go to the Stevenson's Fairgrounds," which is across the street from Factory Fine Camp there, they go to their shifts just across the little gully. At 5 in the morning, Dot Turner came from the encampment and went to work, and then Cheryl at 7, and Tom does the afternoon shift. They just go back and forth, and we broadcast right next to the campfire that kept them warm. And they're continuing now, and they're trying to block the shipments of the machinery on the floor of the plant right now in Freeport that is being sent to China one by one. They have gotten pink slips. They say they will lose their job on November 5th, go to unemployment, and then vote the next day. I told them they better bring photo ID. So these are some of the voices that you get to hear on Democracy Now! And some of the voices you should hear in all the media. You know, what do we get instead? The small circle of pundits who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. We need something different. So covering the Republican convention, we attempted to cover the money. But let me go to the story of Michael Cranish in the book, the biography of Mitt Romney. It's the story of Governor Romney. That's Governor George Romney, the popular Michigan governor, Mitt Romney's father, deciding whether or not to run for president in 1964. A lot of people were trying to draft him. He'd only been governor for 2 years. He turned to his family, to Mitt, who was a high school student. You know, what do you think? And he took Mitt to the 1964 Republican convention. Barry Goldwater was nominated there. He thought Barry Goldwater could destroy the Republican Party. And though he didn't run, he gave a speech at the Republican Platform Committee warning the party against hate and extremism, particularly singling out the John Birch Society. You know, the John Birch Society, fiercely segregationist, racist, taking on the civil rights movement and Dr. Martin Luther King. He said, "This trend will destroy us." He refused to endorse Barry Goldwater, which is interesting, because finally when the candidate is chosen, all the others, you know, have to endorse. It's considered good sportsmanship, and Goldwater was furious, and so Governor Romney wrote him a letter, a many-page letter, explaining why he would never endorse him. Fast forward to now, and you have the sons of the co-founder of the John Birch Society shaking hands with the son of the Michigan governor, who warned his own party about the hate and extremism that could destroy them. Just an interesting story. So we went to the Republican convention to follow the money, and I went to interview David Koch. My colleague Mike Burke went to interview Sheldon Adelson, you know, the casino magnate from Vegas, who also has casinos in Macau, who says he's going to spend $100 million in this election. This is the first post-Citizens United election. It's very serious. We don't know the $2 billion or so that's going to be spent. Much of that money, where is it from? And so Mike and Hani, Hani, who leaps tall buildings in a single bound, went to walk the corporate suites hallway to see who they'd run into. And they ran into Sheldon Adelson. And so Mike went to ask him, how much are you going to spend? And this woman between Mike and Mr. Adelson steps back and body slams Mike. He's like thrown off balance and doesn't know what's going on. And the next thing she does is grab Hani's camera. He knows how to hold on to his camera, but he just did not expect this. And she runs into the Adelson suite. Hani puts his foot in the door, and she slams the camera on the ground. And so here is Mike back on balance trying to get his Android phone to start taking pictures because they have nothing left. And the Adelson team are trying to pull his phone out of his hand. And then the Adelson spokesperson for the Venetian, you know, the casino, and Mr. Adelson's personal spokesperson comes out and hands his card to Mike and says, we'll take care of this, we'll deal with this, we'll make you whole tomorrow. And Mike's saying, what is going on here? You know, he's seeing Karl Rove going in to pay homage and Newt Gingrich going in. You know, this is the Adelson suite, the golden suites that are overlooking the Republican convention on the fifth floor. And Mike says to the spokesperson, who is that woman? And he said, that would be Mr. Adelson's daughter. And she then comes out and apologizes twice. And this became a big story. It's in the New York Times, Politico, even Glenn Beck had it on his website. You know, the Adelson family attacks the Democracy Now! Team. And the Adelsons know it doesn't look very good, so they issue a press release. They are nothing if not well lawyered up and know how to say things very carefully. You know, he's been investigated for bribery and corruption. And so they put out a press release saying something like, reporters should remain nonviolent. You know, it's careful. In no way is it saying that our team did anything, and of course they wouldn't have. And of course I agree that reporters should be nonviolent. And then they went on to wish us well in covering the Republican convention. So I went to interview David Koch. David Koch was a New York delegate. You know, the Koch brothers, David and Charles Koch, are the oil and gas billionaire magnate funders of the Tea Party movement. They're going to spend something like $400 million in this election. And it's important to follow the money, just the basic tenets of good journalism. So I go over to the New York delegation, he's a New York delegate, with our cameraman, John Hamilton, and I go to ask him a question. I reach out my microphone, he's sitting with other delegates, and I said, Mr. Koch, are you concerned that unchecked concentrated wealth will subvert democracy? All of the delegates around him stood up like a stand of trees that sprouted up in seconds. Now, he is a tall figure, David Koch, but he's a towering figure. But he is cowering behind these delegates who have now stood up. And the only image we could get of him for our website was one eye looking up. And so I go to the guy next to him who stood up to protect him from the question. I think I'll ask him. His name is Ed Cox. It says it on his name tag. Ed Cox is the longtime chair of the Republican Party of New York, and he happens to be the son-in-law of President Richard Nixon. He married Trisha Nixon, Trisha Cox. And I said, are you concerned that unchecked concentrated wealth will subvert democracy? And he said no. So I move on. On the final night of the convention, you know the mystery guest that spoke, Clint Eastwood, and you have this big shadow of Dirty Harry with the automatic, you know, with the rifle that he's holding. And Clint Eastwood comes out, and he brings this empty chair, and he starts talking to, presumably, President Obama. I mean, the implicit racism of the invisible president. Think of Ralph Ellison's The Invisible Man. But then he goes on to say some wild things, like, critics say President Obama said he would close Guantanamo, but, you know, it's been years and he hasn't. That actually isn't very wild. It's pretty legitimate criticism. I just didn't expect to hear it from the stage of the Republican convention. And then he goes on to talk about President Obama presiding over the longest war in U.S. history. And something about Mitt Romney would pull out troops the next day. I'm sure there was no one more surprised than Mitt Romney. And then Mitt Romney makes his entrance. You know, Obama came from the back of the stage, but, you know, this is a big moment. It's the biggest moment of Romney's political career. And he enters from the back and he walks down the aisle. You can't see, there are thousands of people, but we're in New Hampshire now at that delegation. We're seeing on the Jumbotron, wow, Mitt Romney is coming down the aisle. I know very well. I've been walking it for the last 3 days. It's the aisle of the New York delegation. Because I see the pole that is up for New York, and Wisconsin was right next to it, and Utah was right back there. I know this aisle. I see Senator Hatch's sneakers. I know the whole deal here. So I say to John, you got to film the Jumbotron. He says, oh, we'll get the pool feed later. You know, in New York, our team will pull the feed that goes to all the journalists, that goes out to the whole world of, you know, of this convention. And I said, you know, you never know what you're going to get. Film the Jumbotron. And so he films, and you see Romney come down. He hits the area next to David Koch. He stops. He shakes his hand. He puts his arm on him. He points at him, and he makes his way down. And he's shaking other people's hands. That's not really that surprising. He's an enormous donor. So I said, okay, well, later that night at the end of the convention, I called Robbie Caron, our video producer in New York. I said, pull the handshake, and, you know, when we're talking about the Romney-Koch relationship, we'll show that handshake. And he said, there is no such thing on the videotape. I said, what are you talking about? Oh, you probably, Robbie, don't recognize Mr. Koch, because he wasn't really a very, he was very much working behind the scenes until recently. So it wouldn't surprise me to know someone wouldn't recognize me. He said, no. He comes down the aisle, and you see that pole that says New York, and then it cuts away. The video cuts away, and I see these two young women who are very energetic. They've got red, white, and blue boa feather scarves around their necks, and then it shows a full view of the convention floor. This all happens very quickly, like 5 seconds, and then it goes back to Romney walking just past David Koch onto the stage. And I said, wait a second. So send us that video. So John Hamilton puts together for our show the next day the split screen. You see what the world saw, which is the energetic young women and Romney proceeding to shake everyone else's hand. And you see what actually happened, which was the handshake with David Koch. Now, that isn't surprising, that handshake, but the fact that millions didn't see it made it particularly significant. And so we showed that on Democracy Now!, and all of the networks picked it up. You know, the Koch-Romney handshake. Again, we call that trickle-up journalism. And then we move. How long does it take to get to Crested Butte from here? If you're driving real... Did someone say 5 minutes? If you're driving really fast. Oh. Okay, so I'm going to wrap this up quickly. And then we'll go to the back, and we're going to sign books. We got our books from the Tattered Cover in Denver, a wonderful independent bookstore. Support your independent bookstores, because they, like independent media, are a sanctuary of dissent, and we need each and every one of them. So if you get 2 copies of the book, think holidays, birthdays, anniversaries, graduations. Well, let me explain why. I don't know if Dennis explained this, but he went around with Juan Gonzalez, our co-host on Democracy Now!, who came out with this fantastic book. I encourage everyone to read it, called News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race in the American Media. And as they went around, they hit the bestseller list, the New York Times bestseller list. So that meant he came right under Harry Belafonte and knocked Dick Cheney down one notch. And why it's also important is that in a lot of these bookstores now all over the country, they only take the top 10 books or the top 20 books, nothing else. People come into these bookstores, and it's such an opportunity for them to find this whole universe of other ideas and voices that may well resonate with them. So I want to end with Occupy. and with one last story. Wisconsin fueled Occupy. The people of Occupy moved in on September 17th, and you heard it all on Democracy Now. Yes, Chuck, I told them 5 minutes. And they had signs of about every different issue, which I think was its power. And the networks ignored them for a week. It was just amazing to see. And then they ridiculed them. What do these people want? Everyone's got a different, you know, one is about the environment, one is about the death penalty, one is about, oh, the signs were amazing. I'll believe corporations are people when Texas executes one, for example. And then they ridiculed them. But, you know, Mahatma Gandhi said it best. First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. And for anyone who says that the Occupy movement didn't have a message, I think any Madison Avenue PR exec would drool to be the one to be credited with the slogan, "We are the 99%. I don't think there's ever been a more powerful slogan that has occupied the American imagination more than "We are the 99%. And the word "occupy" itself has occupied language all over the world. And we don't even know where it will be, where it will go, how it will show itself. But I wanted to end with this one story in the book. Yeah, there were lots of signs. It was September 17th, and people were holding signs on every issue. And there were a lot of signs that said, "Too much doubt." And "I am Troy Davis." And that's the story I'd like to leave you with. Troy Davis, the African-American man from Savannah, Georgia, who was executed on September 21st, 2011, a few days after people occupied Zuccotti Park. After the occupation, we raced to Georgia to be there for, well, we didn't know if he would be executed. There had been 3 death warrants for him before that had been vacated. We just knew we wanted to broadcast from, if it was up to me, from the execution chamber, because I think we have to see the images. This is such a controversial practice. We're the only country in the industrialized world to execute the death penalty. Most people don't realize this. And at least let's have a discussion about this. Let us see the images, and then people can make up their own mind. But so we headed to Jackson, Georgia, where Georgia's death row prison is. We didn't know what would happen. We started the broadcast at 6. He was scheduled to die at 7. The prison guards, when we came on the grounds, there was a big protest pen erected. They would only allow 150 protesters in. The family was there. The heads of the NAACP and Amnesty were there. Across the street were 1,000 people also protesting, holding candles, like students from Morehouse and Spelman colleges had marched, the historically black colleges from Atlanta. And people were awaiting word what would happen. Now, we were going to do a multi-hour broadcast, and the guards told us we couldn't go near the protest pen. We'd have to be on the outskirts of the grounds. And I looked, and I saw the elite journalists there. Why weren't they protesting this? I'm not going to speak myself for 6 hours. I am here to broadcast the voices of people speaking for themselves. Why would they come hours? Why would they sometimes come across continents to be here to witness this? Not mediated through me. And they said no. Our truck came in. We hired a truck that Fox would hire the next day, CNN hired the day before, and that matters. It comes on the grounds. These things cost money, but they are extremely important. The truck came on, and there was one. I now met people who were bigger than the Oshkosh guards. It was the guys driving the satellite truck. And as they came on the grounds, they said, "Miss Goodman, where do you want to broadcast?" And I said, "Well, the guards are saying, we asked you. You hired this truck. Where do you want to broadcast?" I said, "Well, I was sort of thinking over by," I'm looking nervously at the guards, "over by the protest pen," and they just barrel that truck over to the protest pen. Then they get out and they set up cones. They said, "Where exactly would you like to stand?" as the guards are coming over. And they hand me, and I said, "Well, I was thinking," they hand me the mic and they say, "Start broadcasting." And that was where we positioned ourselves. Let me read this column. And then we'll talk after. By the way, get books. Get one book, get two books, get many books, or don't get any book at all. If you get two, you get this wonderful hour with Michael Moore, just talking about his life on Democracy Now! But also come up even if you don't get a book. If you have ideas for stories, people we should interview, I'd love to meet you. That's why we come out on this 100 City Tour. That's the delight and the joy. Troy Davis and the Machinery of Death. On September 21st at 7 p.m., Troy Anthony Davis was scheduled to die. We were reporting live from outside Georgia's death row prison in Jackson, awaiting news about whether the Supreme Court would spare his life. Davis was sentenced to death for the murder of off-duty Savannah police officer Mark McPhail in 1989. McPhail was a hero cop. He was moonlighting as a security guard at Burger King. He saw that a homeless man was being pistol whipped in the parking lot. He went to his aid and someone shot him dead. Now, at the question was, who did it? At the trial of Troy Anthony Davis, 7 of the 9 non-police witnesses later recanted or changed their testimony, some alleging police intimidation for their original false statements. One who did not recant was the man who many have named as the actual killer. No physical evidence linked Davis to the shooting. Davis was one of 3,200 prisoners on death row in the United States. He had faced 3 prior executions, with each one global awareness grew. So many people were calling for clemency. The Pope, the Republican Congress member from Georgia, the former Congressman Bob Barr, the former director of the FBI, William Sessions, the prison warden, the former prison warden of the death row prison, together with 5 other prison wardens around the country who were pro-death penalty, said no, too much doubt when it comes to Troy Anthony Davis. It was just that doubt that galvanized protests around the world. When we came onto the grounds of the prison, we're handed a very thin press kit. The press kit talked about Troy Davis's last day, what his schedule would be, 9 to 3. He could see family, then they'd have to clear out for a routine physical. Routine physical? You know that recently in Texas, a man attempted suicide on death row. They raced him to the hospital, got him better, and then killed him. Routine physical? And then there was another page. This is what the press packet mainly focused on, what Troy Davis would have for dinner. It was extremely detailed. He had said no to the special meal where a prisoner can order anything they want before they die. He had said no to that. So the press release told us what he would be offered, the standard prison tray. Grilled cheeseburgers, oven-browned potatoes, baked beans, coleslaw, cookies, and a grape beverage. It also listed the lethal cocktail that would follow. Pentobarbital, pancuronium bromide, potassium chloride, and the fourth line said Ativan, in parentheses, a sedative. The pentobarbital anesthetizes, the pancuronium bromide paralyzes, the potassium chloride stops the heart. It was only 2 things that Davis had a choice about. He said no to both, the sedative and the Last Supper. By 7 p.m., the U.S. Supreme Court was reportedly reviewing Davis's plea for a stay. The case was referred to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, who hails from Pinpoint, Georgia, a community founded by freed slaves that's near Savannah, where Davis had lived. The Supreme Court denied the plea. Davis's execution began at 10:53 p.m. A prison spokesperson delivered the news to the reporters outside. Time of death, 11:08 p.m. The eyewitnesses to the execution stepped out. According to an Associated Press reporter who was there, these were Troy Davis's last words. You know how the execution ritual takes place. The prisoner is laid out on a cross-like gurney and strapped down. There's a window. The curtains are pulled back, and the family of the murder victim is sitting there. And then the prisoner has his 2 lawyers, Troy Davis did, and then there are all the reporters. According to the Associated Press reporter, these were Troy Davis's last words. I'd like to address the McPhail family, let you know, despite the situation you're in, I'm not the one who killed your son, your father, your brother. I'm innocent. The incident that happened that night is not my fault. I did not have a gun. All I can ask is that you look deeper into the case so that you really can finally see the truth. I ask my family and friends to continue to fight this fight For those about to take my life, he turned to the executioners and said, God have mercy on your souls. God bless your souls. The state of Georgia took Davis's body to Atlanta for an autopsy, charging the family for the transportation. On Troy Davis's death certificate, the cause of death is listed simply as homicide. As we stood on the grounds of the prison continuing the broadcast, it was about a quarter to midnight. The Department of Corrections threatened to pull the plug on our broadcast. The show was over. And I could only think about the words of Mahatma Gandhi when asked, what do you think of Western civilization? He said, I think it would be a good idea. Democracy Now.